So if you ask the question, you know, how would you describe God? Someone say, well, describe God to me. You know, what's he like? What would you say? Does your description that you've got in your head match the God of these chapters? When we look at the detail, I think actually many of us struggle with the way that God is presented here. Just a few examples. How does chapter 6, verse 7, challenge your view of God? So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created. What about verse 13? So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people. Now it's clear in these chapters that it's God who sent the flood so that every living thing that moved on the land perished. And the result of that, look ahead to chapter 7, verse 22. Everything on dry land that had the breath of life in its nostrils died. Every living thing on the face of the earth was wiped out. People and animals and the creatures that move along the ground and the birds were wiped from the earth. These verses make us, well, make me, possibly us, make us feel uncomfortable. This is Almighty God destroying mankind. This isn't a cute children's story illustrated with a colourful picture of an ark and a rainbow, which is what most people's image is when you say Noah and the ark, that cute little picture. This passage is about the righteous anger of Almighty God poured out on humanity. This is stark and hard and challenging and terrifying. I think it's worth actually just as sort of a step back to think this passage, the issues we have with this passage actually are stemmed from two big problems, two errors that we tend to make. Firstly, the first error is that the God I believe in is smaller than the reality. I make God out to be just a slightly improved version of me. But the reality is that there is a chasm in terms of value and morality and power between me and God. That's the first error. The second error is the flip side of that, is that I think that humanity is bigger or more impressive than the reality. I think we're better than we are. So by making God small and me big, I then read the flood narrative and I can't compute how such drastic action from God could even begin to be justifiable. But when we stop and actually look at chapters like Genesis 6 and 7, it corrects my wayward thinking. This week I have the privilege in my job of spending lots of time looking at these chapters to think, what is God saying so I can teach it? But I've had a deeper appreciation, I think, for the magnificence and holiness and perfection of God. The power of God, the magnificence of God. And on the flip side, I've reflected on the depth and depravity of my own heart. Sadly, my conclusion is that the biblical concept of total depravity of mankind is true. At least about me. And I'm pretty sure about you too. Just as we start, look at verses 1 to 4 of chapter 6. Here, see there, mankind was increasing in number. This is what they're supposed to do. And the sons of God saw the daughters of men were beautiful. Now, we're not actually sure who the sons of God were. One suggestion is they might be the descendants of Seth, and the daughters of man are the descendants of Cain. So the godly line and the sinful line. But that doesn't really flow with how the text reads. The natural reading is that the sons of God are some form of angelic being, but we don't really know. And we could speculate, but we don't really know. And the offspring of those dubious marriages were the Nephilim. Again, we're not really sure who they are either. But what is clear is that God didn't approve. We do know God's analysis on humanity. Look at verse 3. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are mortal. Their days will be 120 years. That 120 years could be the time between God saying this and the flood happening, but also a limitation on mankind's lifespan from then onwards. The consequence of sin, the result of rejecting God's right to rule, it's clear. Our life is limited. We're facing death. God won't allow us to reject him. He'll deal with us." And it becomes even clearer when we look at verse 5, God's shocking analysis of humanity. God's shocking analysis of humanity. Look down there at verse 5. "The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time." The wickedness of humanity was great. Every inclination, not some, not a majority, every inclination was only evil all the time. Every, only, all. A complete and utter condemnation on the state of humanity. Verse 5 doesn't sit comfortably with ourselves, but with our view of humanity in general. Ourselves, but also our progressive culture, believes in the perfectibility of mankind, that we can improve ourselves, we can get better. We think of ourselves as pretty decent, certainly a B+ on a school grade system. You know, none of us would be arrogant enough to say we're a star in the terms of morality, but certainly worth a decent pass mark, much better than average. We're on balance more good than bad. And we feel that we're improving, we're learning as a culture, as individuals. And any issues that we see in ourselves or in society, they can be resolved by education or provision of social improvement or by better finances. You know, if you get those things in place, then humanity will be okay. We look back at history and think we've progressively improved our moral condition. We've improved over time to where we are now, and we're on a trajectory, an ever-improving trajectory. Every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. Well, that might be fair to say of the pit of the world in Noah's day. This past tense was only evil. You know, it's past tense, it's about Noah's day, but not now. You know, if we had a goodness scale of naught to 100, with naught being completely bad and 100 being perfectly good, where would you score yourself? Somewhere between naught and 100, please don't call out. Where would you score yourself on a naught to 100 scale? Well, I'm pretty sure all of us put ourselves somewhere around the 70% mark. Maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit around 70%, because much more than that would be a bit arrogant, but much less wouldn't be right either, because we're better than average on the goodness league table. You know, we do kind things, we care for people, we love others. God's analysis is wrong. But actually, if we deeply consider what God says in verse 5, I think we'll find that God's analysis is sadly right. On our own, nothing we do is perfect. Everything we do falls short. Look carefully at that verse, verse 5. God's analysis, he's not talking about our actions, what we do. It's much deeper than that. It's the thoughts of the human heart. It's our internal thinking. Our natural inclination isn't towards good, but evil. This is our human sinful nature. Now, as we said before, you could be saying that I think I'm making too much of it, I'm being unfair. You know, God, it was past tense, God dealt with that awful generation with the flood. You know, was only evil all of the time. His analysis of us after the flood would actually be much better. We're not quite as bad as they were. Well, straight after the flood, recorded in chapter 8, verse 21, so the flood has happened. Noah's sacrificed in worship to God. God said, The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, never again will I curse the ground because of humans, even though every inclination of the human heart is evil from childhood. And that shocking analysis of our human nature is repeated throughout the Bible and on into the New Testament. Another example, Psalm 51, King David speaking, surely I was sinful from birth, sinful from the time my mother conceived me. But, I hear you cry, that's not fair. People do good things. Not everything is tainted with evil. Well, let's try and answer that in two ways. Firstly, personally, think about yourself. Now, be honest with yourself. We're not going to ask you to write this down. We're not going to ask you to discuss it. Just think honestly about yourself. Think about the last week, or even the last 24 hours, depending how long your memory is. What would you feel like if every thought that you'd had in the last week was available for us all to watch on a YouTube channel? All of it. During every conversation, the subconscious was displayed for all to see. How would you feel about that? Would that back up your claim that you're essentially good? It wouldn't for me. And I would be horrified if you could see my subconscious, the thinking of my heart. I present a falsehood to the world. So that's personally. But it's also true on a theological, ethical level. From ethics perspective, for an action to be good, it must fulfill three criteria. It must be the right thing, done in the right way, for the right reasons. Let me explain that. The right thing. The action must be a good thing. You know, helping an old lady across the road rather than stealing her handbag. That's a good thing to do. It's the right thing. You do it in the right thing, in the right way. You follow the rules and regulations. You don't take shortcuts. The ends never justify the means. For an act to be good, both the ends and the means must be right. And thirdly, the action must be done for the right reasons. And it's in that third area that we all fall short. We consistently fail. We might get the first two wrong as well, but it's the third area where our problems happen. Many of us do good things in the right way, but none of us, before we became a Christian, none of us in our human sinful nature do things for the right reasons. The right reason is for the glory of God. Everyone does things for various reasons, not always selfish actually. It might be for the sake of someone or something else. But no one in their nature does things for the glory of God. And that's a great definition of sin. Sin is taking the glory from God and putting it somewhere else. I'm doing this good act in the right way, but not for God's glory. It's what Adam and Eve did back in chapter 3. They didn't want to follow God's plan. They wanted to be like God. They wanted to share his power and authority and make up their own laws to follow. And we follow their example. We want to be lawmakers. We don't want to follow God's plan. I don't know if you ever watched the TV series Friends, but there was an episode I remember when Phoebe was challenged to do something entirely selflessly for the sake of others. And the whole comedy of the episode was that she completely failed. And the extreme she went, but she couldn't do it. She totally failed to be able to do it. And in our nature, we're all like that. We don't do things in our nature for the right reasons. God's shocking analysis of us is accurate. Look down at verse 11, chapter 6, verse 11. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on earth had corrupted their ways. Now in my heart, I know that describes me. Is it describe you too? Now, we're talking about, as I said, our sinful nature. This is what we were like before God saved us and made us a Christian. It is possible for us to now do things for God's glory. It is possible now, as a Christian, to do a good act, a right thing in the right way for the right reasons. However, we know the truth is that everything we do is still tainted by sin. None of us are perfect. That's true for those of us who are Christians. It's even more so for those who aren't. They're incapable of doing things for the glory of God because they reject Jesus, who is God come to earth as a man. You can't do things for God's glory if you reject Jesus. You've rejected God. So they must be doing it for the glory of someone who isn't God. Therefore, it's a wrong act. Now, the big question is, what do we want God to do about this? Now, at one level, I think we'd quite like him to ignore it. Perhaps just sweep the evil inclinations of our heart under the carpet and let's not deal with it. But if God was like that, it would be awful. It would mean God didn't care about justice, that he didn't put any value on morality, that offence, evil and wrongdoing weren't important to him. And none of us want that. We all believe in justice. If someone has done wrong, we want that dealt with. You know, imagine someone has stolen from you. You'd want that person to be caught and brought to justice and our possessions returned to us. We may well forgive them. Hopefully we would, but you want to see justice happen. A world without justice is a world of anarchy, violence and hatred. We really actually don't want God to ignore sin. The problem is, of course, that puts us and our friends and family in a horrific situation because we're guilty. Because God's analysis of humanity is painfully accurate. That means what happens next is entirely justified. God's cataclysmic judgment on humanity. Look down at verses 6 and 7. God's cataclysmic judgment on humanity. The flood, as we said, it was provoked by human sin. The flood, it was a deliberate act of God. This is the cataclysmic judgment of God against the fundamental wickedness of man. We believe in justice. And this is God acting in righteous anger at humanity's rebellion against him. Now, this wasn't an easy or a light or a superficial action by God. Look at verse 6. The Lord regretted that he'd made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. The word regret there, it's not that God changed his mind, or that he was somehow surprised at how his creation had turned out, that, oh no, it's all gone wrong, I wasn't expecting that. That's not at all what it means. The regret here has the meaning of pain, of sorrow. He'd made mankind in his image, and they'd rejected him. They'd spurned him. They ignored him. They owed him everything, their life, their harvest, their prosperity. Every blessing in their life came from God, and humanity spurned him. I'm all right, God, I'll go my way. Thanks very much for what you've given me, life, prosperity, but no, I don't need you. And because of God's perfection, his power, his holiness, his character, God deserves our constant focus and adulation and worship. Romans 12, our life is a spiritual act of worship, but none of us quite do that. The Westminster Shorter Catechism, which we looked at the men's breakfast last year sometime, puts it this way. First point of that catechism. What is the chief end of man? The chief end of man is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. But none of us do that. All of us fall short. God must deal with it. He warned Adam and Eve back in chapter 2 that if they ate from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they would surely die. Here in chapter 6 and 7, we see the devastating, cataclysmic result of that promise of eating from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And you can see God's reasoning in verse 13. So God, chapter 6, so God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people for the reason the earth is filled with violence because of them. I'm surely going to destroy both them and the earth. And that's what God did. Chapter 7, verse 10. The flood waters came on the earth. Verse 11. On that day, all the springs, the great deep, burst forth, and the floodgates of the heavens were opened. This is an exact reversal of creation recorded in Genesis 1. We looked at the start of September when God held back the waters of the earth and put them in the deep, and he put them in the heavens. This is an act of uncreation, of divine judgment. It's worth saying that actually nearly all ancient cultures have a flood narrative. The Mesopotamians, the Babylonians, which actually gives us good evidence. This is no myth. This isn't a lovely ancient metaphor or myth. It was a real event. Now, whether it was a global flood or a localized one to however far that mankind had spread up to that point is a debatable point. But the cataclysmic nature of God's righteous judgment is clear. And that's why God has recorded this event for us. It's shocking, it's horrifying. And it's an example. It's a warning that God will judge sin. God must judge sin. Judgment awaits us all. Jesus uses this example, this flood narrative, to warn us, to heed the example of what's going on. God's judgment on our sin will happen. Judgment awaits us all. Matthew chapter 24, verse 36, Jesus speaking. It should come up here. But about that day or hour, no one knows. The day or hour is the final judgment when Jesus returns. Not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. As it was in the days of Noah, people carrying on living, ignoring, it's not going to happen. So it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. This example of the flood is a warning for us, an example for us. We need to listen to it. Now, I accept the total depravity of humankind is a humiliating topic for us to think about. We don't like thinking that we're totally depraved. We don't want to ignore God. We don't want to be accused of ignoring God. But the truth is, we do. And we actually want God to deal with wrongdoing. We want justice. But not to fall on us. We want there to be another option. And Noah and the flood help remind us that, of course, there is another option. There is hope. There is salvation. We're only going to very briefly, as I said at the start, touch on it this week. But when we conclude the flood narrative next week, we'll spend much more time delighting in God's gracious salvation for humanity. Noah and his family and all those animals were saved. There is hope. Look at 6, verse 8. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. This is the account of Noah and his family. Noah was a righteous man, this is verse 9 now, blameless among the people of his time. And he walked faithfully with God. Noah walked by faith. Just like Enoch, we thought about last week. Just like Abel, the week before that. Noah had faith in the God of salvation. He didn't trust his own righteousness, he trusted in God. He walked by faith. Verse 22, Noah did everything God commanded him. He faithfully followed God, even though all around him, they'd rejected God. I'm sure he faced ridicule for building the ark, for being different, because he was doing what God told him to do. Can you imagine what the other people were saying as he's there constructing this massive ark? It's huge. Out there in the fields, everyone laughing. What are you doing? He's a great example of how to walk by faith. Yeah, we might be the only Christian at school or at work or at our home, but we can still walk faithfully. We can still trust God, even in the face of a culture that has rejected his right to rule. Noah is an example for us to follow, but he's also an example of the hope that judgment is not the end. There is an alternative. God saved Noah and his family. He told him to build that ark. God gave him the plans, the detail. God preserved mankind and those animals. God acted to bring salvation. The key lesson of the flood is that God will only bring salvation through judgment. Rest, comfort, which is what Noah's name actually means, rest and comfort only comes through the purging of all human sin. Now we know that the flood only temporarily dealt with our depravity. Chapter 8:21, God tells us it's still going on. However, it's a shadow. It's a shadow of the much more significant judgment and salvation that came through a descendant of Noah. Several thousand years later, the Lord Jesus Christ, one of Noah's descendants, he came and he took God's cataclysmic judgment for the sin of humanity. And through that judgment, God graciously offers salvation to humanity. But I think it's important, and deliberately why I've done it this week, we don't skip too quickly from the bad news. It'd be quite easy to preach about Noah and talk about the salvation, the ark and the animals. We're going to do that next week. Don't jump straight to the good news. Remember the good news. Your life's based on it. But pause and reflect on the true nature of your sinful heart. You, me, all of us, according to God's own analysis, are thoroughly evil in our thinking when evil is rejecting God's right to rule. God will judge our sin. And the good news is only good news when we really understand the bad news. When we deeply understand the bad news, the good news is elevated from being good news to being momentous news, extraordinary news, the greatest news you will ever, ever hear. So the key question is, will you accept Jesus taking your punishment for your sin on the cross? Or will you wait for the return of Jesus and face God's cataclysmic judgment on your sin yourself? Who will take the punishment you deserve for your sin? Jesus or you?